Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
You're listening to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. This is Matt. I'm joined by Ben. And Ben, good day.
Hey, guys. Good day. Good day to you.
We have a really exciting top of the morning. We always ask for listener feedback. Sweet voice you hear do the outro. It's actually Ben's daughter. I don't know if we've ever said that before. Mm-hmm. Ben's daughter, Raina. Yeah. And she invites you to share ideas with us. And one
she's
of our listeners.
Now. I still think she's like nine.
I know. No. She's not nine anymore.
She's not nine. Nine. Definitely not nine.
Yeah. She's,
we would
she's
not our, let her be up at college.
She's already totaled one car.
So
she's
definitely older than nine.
Yeah, true.
She invites you to share things with us. And a friend of the show, Jenny, who lives in Sweden, she's a pastor in Sweden. She emailed us and introduced us to a friend of hers, a person that she knows, who is a Swedish professor of theology, Stockholm School of Theology. His name's Joel Halldorf. And Joel is a Swedish evangelical, Pentecostal, in fact, and he's written a book about the rise of Pentecostalism in Sweden. And in this series of being a Christian in America, I thought, wow, what if we got an evangelical Christian from Sweden to look at what do you notice about American evangelicalism, dude? Yeah. You know, just give us like an insider/outsider look and tell us what you see. And this interview is fascinating. We're going to link an article that Joel wrote in the show notes that expands a bit on this interview. I highly encourage you to look at that. He's got a book he published too. But he lifts up the hood of our car. And I just had the picture of, you know, like when you, you look at... you know those expose shows when they go to a hotel room and you look at like a comforter or the duvet and it's fine and they turn the lights off and they turn the black light on and you see everything the black light reveals, you know? Like, honestly, I feel like Joel shines a black light on our culture and our faith, and it's so invaluable. Anyway, I'm excited about this interview. I had to do it myself. You guys were busy saving the world and loving people. And I was just talking to Joel. Yep. But we have a few announcements. Things coming up that you can't miss, or you could, but you might regret it. Ben, you want to share about those?
Yes. One of them is the Church in the Wild. Actually, this might be the only one, but we'll see. Church in the Wild workshop. It is coming up November 13th and 14th. This is an online workshop, so you can attend anywhere you live in the world, as long as you can deal with the time difference. It's going to take place Friday night, November 13th from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern, and then Saturday morning from 10 a.m. Eastern to 1 p.m. Eastern. And Church in the Wild is a workshop about Christian witness in post-Christendom. So what does it look like to be the body of Christ, to proclaim the good news of Jesus, to be an embodiment of a community that the gospel that believes the gospel? What does that actually look like when we're not in charge anymore, when we can't leverage our authority as the people who know what's going on, who are going to tell you what's good for you? Like, I don't think, again, probably nobody took that posture before, but we have had to learn as the church how to witness to the goodness of God from a place of not being automatically trusted or liked. And so anyway, we're learning a lot about it, and would invite you to come to that workshop.
I'm really excited about that. Friday morning. I think that's going to be a really fun event. I'm excited for the content, and also just excited that for the conversation that's going to come out of that. I think it's going to be great conversations and great talking points for all of us.
Yep. Yeah. That's a good point. Hardman, this isn't going to be a webinar where you just log in and kind of watch it happen, but it's a Zoom call. And so we're limiting registration to the amount of people who can actually be on a Zoom call. So we'll have some interaction. So we'll have teaching inputs and that kind of thing to kind of jog people's thoughts. But after we do that, we are interested in finding out what the learning is in the room. So we don't know everything that's going to be said because we don't know who's coming. So come. Yeah. And say something.
Yeah.
You're with us, and it'll be part of it. So that's looking forward to that. There's a link to that in the show notes, or you can just go to gravityleadership.com/church, and it'll give you a link to this specific workshop.
All right. That's C-H-U-R-C-H.
C-H-U-R-C-H. C-H-U-R-C-H.
Yep. Cap C or lowercase c.
Doesn't matter. Go to gravityleadership.com/church.
With no further jiggery pokery, here is Joel Halldorf. Joel Halldorf, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes, Joel is the Associate Professor of Historical Theology at the Stockholm School of Theology. He researches evangelicalism and modernity, historical pacifism, Pentecostalism, and worship in the evangelical tradition. Joel has recently had a book that was translated into English, published called Pentecostal Politics in a Secular World. Joel, that's all the nitty-gritty details here. What am I missing about Joel Halldorf?
Well, you know, every life is a long journey, but we shouldn't spend this podcast into the details there. But I think you got the formalities right. Yeah, I'm from Sweden. I've been quite a bit in the U.S. I have some family there, and I've done some. Was a visiting scholar at Duke University back in 2008, actually the Obama year. So I've been back and forth some since.
Okay, just parenthetically, you're on our podcast. You're the first Swedish person on our podcast.
Oh, what an honor! Thanks.
And we have a mutual friend. Jenny is a Patreon supporter of the podcast, and she connected the two of us and said, "Hey, you're doing this series on how to be a Christian in America. I think you should talk to one of my professors, Joel. He's Swedish." And I was like, "Well, what would a Swedish person have to say about what it means to be a Christian in America?" And then I read some of the things you've written about the history of evangelicalism and Pentecostalism in Sweden and how that is distinct from the history of evangelicalism and Pentecostalism in America. So maybe we'll just, I mean, this is a huge topic, Joel, and there's lots of things to get to, but maybe just as we sit here in 2020 and you look across the pond to America, what strikes you as most distinctive about the differences between Swedish evangelicalism and American evangelicalism?
Yeah, so yeah, that's a huge question. Perhaps if I answered like this, that I grew up in a Pentecostal church here in Sweden. I am fourth. My like father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were all Pentecostal ministers, pastors. So I know the movement pretty well, and I'm like deep into it in my upbringing. And of course, there's a strong connection also to the United States, to both Pentecostalism and evangelicalism. I mean, we would sing the same worship songs. We would read the same like big evangelical writers like Bill Hybels and all those figures. They are translated. But there's always been one thing that Swedish evangelicals have a hard time understanding when it comes to their U.S. counterparts, and that is politics. It is very, very different. And that's, I mean, I discovered it. My first year in the U.S. was the 2000. I tend to be there when there is an election. I don't know. But that was the Bush Gore. And that was I mean, and I talked to my relatives and friends, and I just like, I could not understand how you could use the Bible to like, support welfare cuts or promote the right to have guns. I mean, where I come from, evangelicals are mostly pacifists, and we tend to, I mean, be culturally conservative, but economically, I mean, historically at least, we've been economically progressives, and not wanting a small state, wanting a Christian state, but the state that sort of like takes care of the poor and everything. So that's, I mean, we speak different political languages.
Yes. Okay. So then I hear like some big differences here, and I want to double click on these because it's fascinating. In your writings, you detail this a bit. Why this is the case? Mm-hmm. But you mentioned violence. Mm-hmm. Guns, mm-hmm. and the role of the state in mm-hmm. taking care of the poor. Mm-hmm. And so just a few clarifying questions for Americans. We don't know anything about America, let alone the rest of the world. there often is thrown around in America that Sweden is a socialist country. Is that true? And what's true about that and what isn't true about that?
Yeah, so we've had a strong, I mean, from the 1930s to the 1970s, Sweden had a almost uninterrupted social democratic government, and that meant an expansion of the welfare state and a rather high level of taxation, relatively speaking. I mean, not. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no, very few, like, no limits of freedom, and so forth. But some areas have been state regulated that are not in the same way regulated in the U.S., such as media. TV and radio broadcasting was not privatized until the 1990s. After the 1980s, a lot of things changed, and Sweden moved more in a even more like a politically liberal direction, as did all of Western Europe. It was the Thatcher and Reagan years and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so today you wouldn't. I mean, we have free healthcare, free higher education, and some things like that. But it's not like, I mean, the comparison with Cuba or Soviet Union. I mean, that's just not realistic.
That's a caricature or maybe a pejorative boogeyman.
Yeah, definitely so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk then about how evangelicals in Sweden, it sounds like evangelicals in Sweden are more associated with the left than the right.
Yeah, I think you should, I mean, as an historian, I like to understand these things by sort of telling a story. And I think you need to go back to the sort of like emergence of evangelicalism, or the breakthrough at least in the 19th century. And then you see that there's quite similar political instincts in the U.S. and in Sweden. I mean, the evangelical movement in the U.S. is also is rather progressive then, working for social justice, working against slavery. I mean, the mm-hmm. work of revivalist Charles Finney, who is famous, and yeah. who like women's rights and so forth. And the same in Sweden, that evangelicals come from below, lower class background, and they want a society that is more democratic and that is more just. So in that sense, they share the political instincts of the left. They don't want a revolution, so they don't share the methods. They end up in the political liberal camp, sort of in the middle between the conservative and the socialist. But they are definitely, I mean, more inclined. They have much in common with the workers' movement. That's also of the 19th century.
Yeah, and so then Sweden became a democracy, then it left sort of a monarchy. Is that the historical arc?
Yeah, exactly. So the democratic breakthrough in Europe and in Sweden is around the year 1900, and it's a slow and steady walk from monarchy to democracy. And I mean, here is also a huge difference from the American historical experience, the Swedish society of the 19th century is very unjust. I mean, there are big, economic differences and so forth, and there is a sort of a conservative elite of the nobility, the priests, the military, the monarchy, that wants to keep the system. But evangelicals in Sweden, and it's the same in Britain, they belong to a progressive middle class, working class, and they want to change this. And this creates an alliance between the evangelicals and the labor movement, who both want the same thing. They want democratic reform. And that's sort of that stamps the evangelical movement, something that remains throughout the 20th century, that they are sort of liberal, left-leaning. I mean, it's starting to change perhaps the last decade or so, but we can talk about that later. But that's the sort of like the instinct.
Yeah, so let me see if I got the gist of this, which is the monarchy in Europe and in more particularly in Sweden was aligned with the state church. Was it a Lutheran state church?
Yeah, Lutheran state church.
And they were the conservatives. They wanted to conserve the power and the few and the strict hierarchy of the monarchy, et cetera, et cetera. And there were some pretty bad economic repercussions for people who weren't, you know, in charge. Mm-hmm. And so then evangelicals found political advocates comrades, no pun intended, with the Labour Party, right? Mm-hmm. So the Labour Party, the left, wanted to create democratic freedom and give power to people and have it be more of a democratic republic than just a monarchy. And so the evangelicals and Labour Party aligned 150 years ago to advocate for that, and they really haven't split up since.
That's a good summary.
Yeah, which is a different story than in America. So I know you've studied this. So how would you then, could you tell the story of America and draw out the contrasts about how evangelicalism emerged within, you know, the last 100 years here?
Yeah, so you have one thing is to see the role of the state in the different political projects, where in Sweden and in much of Europe, the democratic state becomes sort of a vehicle for reform and freedom, basically. While in the US, you have a founding myth that is that freedom is freedom from the state, because that's the pilgrims. I mean, they went away from the oppressive states of Europe and established. So there's a strong, culturally in the U.S., a strong anti-statist theme that is not so strongly present in Europe. So that's one thing. But then you have some conflicts in the early or some in the early 20th century in the U.S. That strongly seemed to shape the political instincts of U.S. evangelicalism. And that's one of the things is the fundamentalist modernist conflict with the Scopes trials and things. I don't know how much of common knowledge this is to your audience.
Yeah, I think most people remember in somewhere in their memory that there was a trial about Darwin being teaching evolution in schools. It was the Scopes monkey trial is what you're referring to, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was two sides. One was the kind of the religious side of not wanting to teach evolution in schools. And the other side was, no, let's teach this thing in schools. And that's where the modernist and the fundamentalist sort of had, it was sort of the hallmark of the divide, or maybe the epitome of what separated that in America. Am I getting the gist of it?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the what historian George Marston describes as the Great Divide. And then, because then you have also theologically, when you look at conservative and liberals, you've had sort of a broader alliance in the 19th century, where they have been part of a sort of a progressive movement, church-wise. But then you split up, you have the fundamentalist or the conservative and the liberal against each other. And sort of the theme of social justice within white Protestantism ends up in the liberal camp. I mean, this is one of the great tragedies of church history, that some themes that should belong to Christians, when the church in general, when the splits happen, I mean, it becomes located in one group, and social justice becomes associated with the mainline or the liberal churches, and seems to be neglected among the evangelicals and Pentecostals. This does not happen in Sweden. It doesn't happen within African-American evangelicalism either, where you have much more of a social progressive spirit among in those churches. But that's also a very defining development in U.S. evangelicalism.
Yes, the separation of white church and black church, and how racism plays a role in that, and just various institutions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have the sort of a loss of a social conscience, at least working for social justice. I mean, you could have sort of local projects, but working for social justice through the state is not something that sits well with U.S. white evangelicalism, and they drift more and more into the Republican camp, and that is consolidated in the 1970s with the rise of the religious right and moral majority and such organizations.
Yeah, let me see then if I can summarize. So in Sweden, Christians, evangelical Christians, saw working with the state as helping them accomplish justice. And in America, evangelicals, fundamentalists in the early 20th century began to see the state as something that would compromise or be an enemy of justice. And so this, you called it anti-statism, that kind of runs through the American story. You know, I mean, we were born out of like sticking it to the man, you know, throwing his tea into the Boston Harbor. And so that we sort of have this rebellious mistrust the state kind of streak, whereas that's not really a part of Sweden's story, because the evangelicals were at the table helping construct a better state.
They were deeply involved in, I mean, a lot of high representative in the parliament and so forth. And the group I've been studying is one of the more radical branches of evangelicalism, namely Swedish Pentecostalism. And the leader there, Levi Petrus, he gets fairly early involved in politics for being a Pentecostal, already in the 1940s and 50s. And he is critical against the political development in Sweden, because he thinks they have taken a secular turn. He is opposed to secularization and wants to have a more morally conservative state. But he's very clear that he eventually founds a party in 1964, the Christian Democrats. But he says that we should have sort of morally conservative culture politics, but we should have a economic politics that is similar to the Social Democrats. So the expansions of the welfare state with increased, I think what's on the table then is more vacation and shorter work week. They want to support that. So they get behind the socialists, so to speak, in the financial questions.
Yeah. So you're saying like the more religiously conservative one got, the more socially liberal they got as well.
Perhaps not more, I would say, but it's the general. I mean, if you look at the evangelical vote in the 1950s, then you have 55% of them are voting for the Liberal Party, 30% are voting for the Social Democrats, and 10% are voting for the Conservatives. So it's quite heavily aligned with the sort of social liberal political identity there.
Yeah.
And it seems to be across the board. Then the Pentecostals start to move a little more in a conservative direction as the 20th century progresses. But that's the big picture.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
One of the other distinctions I'm hearing you talk about, Joel, that I think is fascinating is that there was never a time, it seems like, when evangelicals were divided about social justice. So social justice is part and parcel to what it means to follow Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, if I follow Jesus, then I'm going to care about how justice is worked out in society.
Yeah.
Right? Including the things that maybe get lumped into a liberal or progressive agenda, which is caring for the poor, providing health care, those kinds of things. Whereas in America, it's almost a religious slur nowadays to be called a social justice warrior.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, if you say Black Lives Matter, in some white evangelical spaces, many, you're a kind of a pariah. You're sort of, it's verboten to say that. Mm. And usually it's because, you know, Black Lives Matter has their website talks about they're trained Marxists, and this is... That like the worst thing you can be as a Christian right now. I think pedophilia is still the worst, but just under that is being a Marxist.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if is there an anxiety in Sweden about that, any of that, or is that a uniquely American thing?
I think the culture wars are like becoming more and more global, and also affecting Christianity and society in general all over the world, and to me this is partly why I want to write this book and emphasize this to also remind Swedish evangelicals that you don't have to mimic American politics. I mean, there is a rich heritage here, because of course what we tend to do is we look at these movements like Black Lives Matter and like the social justice struggle, and we define them by their most perhaps extreme examples, and instead of just like, I mean, if we would just more like listen in, what's the main message here? It's that there is a structural racism in the USA and in many Western countries that we need to deal with, and we might disagree of exactly where that line begins and ends, we might disagree about some methods, but there is still a lot of common ground to be found in just that basic analysis. And then we can just decide on war, or we can decide on alliance. And I think many Christians and churches should try to decide on alliance much more than what's done now.
Yeah, well, the culture war, that might not be a uniquely American thing, but definitely we've exported lots of things to Sweden, and it sounds like we finally got you to buy into the culture war too. I really am. I'm sorry about that.
We get some good things too. Ben and Jerry's. Yes. I mean, it almost makes up for it.
Yeah. Some Cherry Garcia makes the culture war feel better.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things we hear a lot about in America, and it's usually kind of spoken in kind of scare tactic and fear, is that there is this creeping secularism, you know, in Europe, and the bigger the state gets, the more secular it gets, and then the scarier that is for Christians, right? Because the big secular, even I'll use the word socialist because that's what's talked about here. The big secular socialist state, if they get power, they are going to strip you of your religious freedoms and your freedom of speech and your all the freedoms you hold dear. Is that particular to America? Do you experience any of that anxiety in Sweden?
We have a secular political framework in Sweden and Europe, as you to some extent have in the US too, and there seems to be sometimes a move from judicial bureaucratic secularism to cultural secularism. That is something that we need to think about as churches, how we handle, because ultimately, at least in Sweden, the evangelical churches have been promoting a more secular state because they don't want to be discriminated by the Lutheran state church and so forth. So we've been wanting that, and I think we should still want that. But I think that we need to think about what secularism means here. That it should mean like an openness to pluralism. For instance, that the state can cooperate closely with churches and religious denominations. And that's something that I've been trying to argue in the Swedish context, because some say that, well, then the state needs to stay away from the churches. So there is a sort of conflict of interpretation going on there, I would say, in Sweden.
Yeah. You just referenced kind of a dynamic that I don't think I'd thought about before, and I want to bounce it off you to make sure I'm hearing you right. I think you just referenced that Swedish evangelicals and Pentecostals see the secular government as protection against maybe the hegemony of the state church.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's something that's very different than America. In America, we don't have a state church.
Yeah.
So we never needed the government to protect us as minorities against a religious majority that we didn't identify with.
Yeah.
I wonder, so what that means is that in the founding of our country, we have this mythos in America that we are a Christian nation. This is part of, it doesn't sound like Sweden has that delusion to deconstruct and overcome. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, definitely so. I mean, and I think that's a very important aspect to understand when it comes to the attraction of Trump and the culture wars, that Swedish evangelicals view themselves as minorities. So they don't have, I mean, there is some anxiety about secularization and pluralism, but not nearly as much, because that's sort of, I mean, if the state would become like homogenous and just one thing, that would threaten their space, sort of. So they want the state to be neutral and to take a step back in these questions. And they so that's why, like, evangelicals, when you measure these things, are more positive than the average secular voter that to allow Muslims to be allowed to build mosques, because they understand that religious freedom is for all, is the condition upon which they, I mean, their existence depends. While it seems to me that in America there is much more like I said, anxiety with the fact that if the state becomes secular, if the society becomes pluralistic, we're sort of going to lose our standing in society, the WASP identity and so forth.
Yeah, so there's a real power dynamic here, isn't there, Joel?
Mm-hmm.
In America, religious evangelicals white evangelicals have felt like they've had power, mm-hmm. and the state is a threat to that power. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Sweden, white evangelicals and Pentecostals never had the illusion that they had power, and so the state protected them against people that did.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was a long struggle for religious freedom and the right to. I mean, Sweden was slow in that. I mean, it was not until the mid 19th century that you were allowed to not be part of the Swedish Lutheran Church, and full religious freedom was established only in 1951. So that is something that has been like a long struggle, and that freedom has been sort of like the bedrock for, I mean, like I said, what makes our existence possible. So that's something that we've been struggling for.
Yeah, this has been a fascinating conversation, Joel. I think for many of us in America, our consciousness of what it means to be a Christian, it's really hard to extricate it out of what it means to be an American.
Yeah.
So they're so conflated and so sort of synonymous in our minds, that it really helps you to talk about, the evangelical faith in another country that, you know, we have the same doctrinal statements, maybe the same creedal confessions, the same commitments to Jesus and Scripture and God and those things, but there's such a different embodiment of what it means to follow Jesus. And I got to tell you, the people I talk to, especially since 2016, you know, you mentioned the election of Trump. I don't think Trump changed things in America. He just made the contrast of what's always been true much more stark. So he brought the blacks and the whites. I mean that in terms of, not in terms of race, but in terms of the hues were much more sharp, and there were less grays, and we could see things more clearly. I wonder, as we wrap up here, Joel, what would you, if you were talking to a family member who was trying to get their bearings in America of how to be a faithful Christian, but engaged politically, what would be some of the encouragement, some of the exhortations you would give us?
In the U.S.? Yes. Family member in the... Yeah,
Help us. We're your brothers and sisters. We need your help.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it seems like the mission of the church in like through all history has been seen itself as the peacemakers. I mean, that's what Jesus called us to. And if you look at many of the rituals of the church throughout history and in the liturgy today, they are involved in creating peace. The greeting of the peace, I don't know what you call it in English.
Passing of the peace.
Exactly, yeah. And the fact that you have a meal there and so forth. So I think that the church really needs to be a political body just by being able to include and create peace and understanding and a listening between with what would be political opponents, because I think we are living in such a politicized time, and the church is also drawn into politics, so we define each other after our political opinions and so forth, and here we have to find other rooms where we can meet sort of beyond party politics, but with repercussions and results for that. And I think the church can be such a room, and that we can like show that it is possible, because what's so evident when you look from the outside of on American politics is that, I mean, the polarization, I mean, pushes the two sides further and further away from each other, and makes the system very dysfunctional, and creates extremism. So that I would say would be the political task of the church in the U.S. and so forth to create the peace and in the churches.
Yeah, it's interesting. you don't often hear evangelicals in America advocating for and putting their stake in the ground with peace. You don't. There's kind of a militarism and a nationalism, and maybe it's caught up in this American masculine kind of violent imagery we have, and we have all these warrior images and soldiers of Christ images, and I'm just struck, Joel, that you're right that our faith, our scriptures, our tradition, church history, the flag is firmly planted in the ground of being a peacemaker. Mm-hmm. And if we only knew the things that would make for peace, that we would be saved from our violent, destructive ends. And so I receive that as a challenge. I'm just wondering, what would a political imagination in America for Christians be if we decided that making peace, reconciliation, if that became the thing that we were known by politically?
Exactly.
You know, the other things we're known by, maybe if those were turned down. Well, Joel, this has been really fascinating. I know we just scraped the surface of the things we could talk about, but I do want to just thank you. I think the brief sketches of history of Sweden and then America, and describing how even it's possible to be evangelical, to hold to, you know, the doctrines and creeds and truthfulness of our faith, that it can embody a different politic, a different way of being in the world than what we usually see scripted in America. I think you've really helped our imaginations maybe grow a bit today. How can people connect with you virtually? Are you active on the social medias?
Yeah, I have a Twitter account, at Joel SH. That's my Twitter handle. I don't know how we pronounce Joel. It's my initials. Joel Samuel Haldorf. That's what it is.
Great.
So you can also just, I mean, I think there are two of us in the world, so you can just Google me, and then you'll find either this other poor guy or me.
You know, I have somebody's name's Matt Ebby. And so my Twitter handle has three T's, Matt Tebby, but his Twitter handle only has two T's, and his Gmail only has two T's. He gets all kinds of messages from me, so I know what it's like to have a poor person that gets mistaken as you.
Exactly.
The book again is called Pentecostal Politics in a Secular World, The Life and Leadership of, I'm going to mess this guy's name up, Levi Petrus?
I'm pretty good, yeah. No mess up. Oh. Good.
Joel, bless you. Yeah. Thank you for being with us today.
Likewise. Thank you for having me. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebby, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online, as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.